This is side one of the first of two tapes, an interview between Martin Duffy, Professor, Labor Education, University of Minnesota, Christine Miller, Research Analyst, University of Minnesota, and myself concerning the General Drivers' Strike, 1934. These tapes were transcribed September 5, 1979, 9 a.m. This is September 5, 1979, 9 a.m. These tapes are interview number 7 in this series about the Minneapolis General Drivers' Strike. And Christine Miller, Research Analyst, University of Minnesota Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Drivers' Strike of 1934. There is a small duplication because of tape overrun on this introduction.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Miller.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
How are you? Are you able
to I'm ready.
Do an interview?
I am.
Oh, very good. Okay. Listen, I want to tell you that I got all that material that you sent me, and it's just wonderful.
Well, I have all sorts of things, you know, and I don't know how much of it's going to be pertinent to you, but...
So I was personally very interested in the articles about Vicky Saporta, and I shared them with a person here in the office who's very interested in organizing.
Mm-hmm.
He's collecting articles, so...
Well, I have some more. I'll pass them along.
Great. He'd love to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that one about the women's role in labor struggles. That I liked very much. You really... have some very strong feelings about that owner-operator's situation.
I do.
Do you think that situation is going to change at all?
Not with the present leadership of the Teamsters Union.
How would it change?
What?
How could it change?
The only way it could be changed, we laid the groundwork for it in the strikes, and I think I sent you how we dealt with them in 1930s.
Yes.
The role of the Teamster Union has been, from my observation of it, one of complete indifference. The language of the contract is there to protect these men that are individual workers. The Teamster Union have walked aside and forgotten them because the people that are in control of the union today are not concerned with a handful of people they consider that they can control one way or another, but they're fast getting to the point where they're out of control. We had a similar situation in that period, and we embraced the support of those men. And the situation as it is, where more and more, particularly with the passage of so many laws where pension plans and all this, that, and the other are concerned, fringe benefits and the issue down in California where they're trying to make them employees. The Teamsters Union gives lip service to this, and that's all. And until they get off the dime and start a responsible approach to the independent owner that drives one truck and puts those that are entrepreneurs and want to be young small fleet owners into another group and protect the contracts to where the end where they don't be eroded by indiscriminate and promiscuous use of these little small 2x4 fleets of sub-haulers, the problem is going to grow. It's strictly a matter that the Teamsters Union has to square up to. And I don't see any point in my knowledge of them where they are doing it. Now, there may be an instance or two scattered throughout the some 1,500-odd locals of the Teamsters Union that's taking a different position. But the Teamsters Union seems to have been prone to returning the Teamsters Union to the barony to which we attempted to take it away from and put it in the hands of the men. The present leadership of the Teamsters Union, in my opinion, believes in the rule of the baronial empire. That's the way Tobin ruled the union prior to 1937. And when Hoffa went to jail, Fitzsimmons, who is, in my opinion, doesn't have what it takes to administer that job, he allowed the baronial princes to return it to their form, where the local joint council wields power and starts an erosion of the contracts by giving riders and special deals to special people. That's what I think of it.
Now, you've been talking about the baronial powers that make decisions, and that makes me think of this Union Area Committee report of 1940, where it was announced that Farrell Dobbs had resigned his position as the general organizer for the Teamsters, and in order to spend full time doing organizing for the SWP.
Right.
And that he was replaced by a man by the name of Neal.
Yeah.
And who was appointed by Tobin.
Yes.
Now, what kind of person was Neal, and what kind of appointment was that?
Huh?
Was that was Neal a crony of Tobin?
Oh, no.
No?
Are you prepared to discuss that?
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit about it, unless you think we should talk about it later.
Look, you're trying to pick my memory, and I'm not a bit at all willing to let you know. When we first started to organize the area committee, now you must remember that right shortly after, in March of about 35, we were expelled from the Teamsters Union. We fought for about 15 or 18 months for reinstatement, which we finally achieved in August or September of 1936. We immediately started then to lay the groundwork for what we had been doing on a local basis. See, as a union non-affiliated with the IBT, having sister locals in St. Paul and various parts around there in Duluth and in Chicago, we were at a little bit disadvantaged to go out and start organizing people out in the hinterlands on the grounds that we would then be doing what Tobin accused us of doing, organizing a dual union. We wanted reinstatement into the Teamsters. Dobbs and Carl and Ray and all of the primary leaders in the union arguing for reinstatement into the Teamsters Union. As soon as we got back within the folds of the Teamsters, Farrell Dobbs and Pat Corcoran were going to Indianapolis to present the plan in the fall of 1937 when Pat got killed, and of course that slowed down some of it. But prior to our re-entry into the Teamsters Union in the fall of 36, we had to tie up all the loose ends. And in the spring of 37, we started out on an embryonic campaign of mostly in the local areas first, Eau Claire, Mankato, places like that. Then we had a meeting, I forget where that one was held. We had one in Cloquet, Minnesota of 1937, and there we set up the formal structure for what was become the North Central District Drivers Council. And about that time, let's see now, I went out into Sioux Falls in October of 37. We had a strike there. We won it. I went down into Sioux City. I went on and into Omaha and into Des Moines, Iowa. And about that time, we met Ted Neal. Ted Neal was an actual driver. He had worked for one of the big grocery stores as a line driver on the road. He was a line driver, over-the-road driver. He was the business agent of Local 41, or Secretary Treasurer. He was Secretary Treasurer of Local 41. He'd been elected in a kind of a popular vote, I believe. Now, I'm not too familiar with the situation in Kansas City in 36, but I think Ted was elected. He was a nice fellow, very good guy. He was an able supporter of the area program, and he was with us in all the founding meetings. He went at all times, and he was a good guy, and of the whole committee, he was more or less recommended to Tobin by Farrell, who thought that he was the best of the group. They had some strong people in Chicago, but they were concerned about staying in Chicago, Mike Healy and Sandy O'Brien. Joe Slezowski, the chairman from Milwaukee, he was an older fellow, and he was more or less, you might say, I don't want to be disrespectful, but he was more of a figurehead. He was the president of Local 200, and he was older in years, and there were some internal problems in his union that he had also. So he didn't want to get away from the store. A lot of these guys didn't want to leave their ballywick because the upstarts might form a faction and drive them out. At least that's my guess. Carl Coyle from Des Moines, Iowa, he didn't have the ability. And of all the people that were left, Ted Neal was the best. Tobin appointed him. And by and large, he done a fair job, but he didn't have the scope, the understanding, the background, and whatever it was needed that Farrell had. I don't think there is anyone that was in the Teamster periphery at the time could have done the job that Farrell did.
Why was it? He could just see further into the future? Then?
Well, he, for one, had 3 years of being secretary of Local 574 under the most trying of conditions, fighting for reinstatement. Besides that, early in 35, he told me that he had decided that in order to really understand the whole situation, it would be well to get some idea of the political life of America rather than the Democratic or Republican approach, although he had voted a Republican. Now, he was naturally, I don't want to be like I'm just bragging the man up, but he was more or less a genius in the field of organization, and he had a knack where he could understand people. He was firm, but he never got the idea that he was uppity and arrogant. And he just had an ability to, charisma and fact and a phenomenal memory and ability to assemble the facts, sort out the junk, and get down to the meat of it. Well, Ted Neal was a truck driver, had probably the usual education, high school, probably a year or two in college, or not, and was a family man with more or less a Kansas City approach or a Minneapolis approach that an average guy would have rather than what I consider the intellectual, far-seeing development that Dobbs had. So, and then Farrell had enough ability to kind of make peace with the warring factions. There were people in the Teamsters Union who were exceedingly jealous of their own domains, you know. Now, in the apparatus in Kansas City was Roy Williams, who's now, by the way, the chairman of that committee. He and O.B. Enlow were opposing Neal at that time. They were making it very difficult for Neal. Now, and then there was a fellow over in St. Louis who done everything he could direct the area committee, That was a fellow by the name of Cammy, Louis Cammy. And he done everything he could to destroy the area committee. Likewise, there was a fellow in an international vice president, Ed Murphy, in Cleveland. And they were doing all they could to sabotage the efforts. So Neil was putting quite a fight up against Enloe and Roy Williams. And they were just on their way up at the time. And they, of course, couldn't understand the magnitude and the idea of the area committee and what it would really mean to the Teamsters in future years. So each of these places, now Cammy more or less controlled the Teamster Joint Council in St. Louis. Ed Murphy was the spark plug in Cleveland. Les Gowdy was the chairman of the Joint Council in Chicago at the time, but he was not the strong man. The strong man in Chicago was Sandy O'Brien, of all the Teamster locals. So there was effort among various of the Teamster unions vying for a place in the sun, to put it more poetic. And they were a little bit, I think, apprehensive that somebody else might get there first. And Neil played a good role in the formative days. And when I left the committee in 1940, in July, he was doing a fair to reasonable job, reasonably good job. But then when the war come on and all that thing, Neil wasn't able to cope with it, and then everybody started going huckley buck, and I think it went into a shambles. I lost sight of it for a few years there, the insides of it. I didn't have any way of getting access to any information or anything like that. Now, that's a kind of a brief history on Neil and what had happened.
You said that certainly answered my question. I just wondered to what extent because he wasn't appointed by Tobin.
But Dobbs was also appointed by Tobin.
I see.
All general organizers are appointed by Tobin. The international president of the Teamsters Union has got the power of Christ, you know. Yeah, and they appoint them all. So it's no snigma that Neil was appointed by Tobin.
That's what I was thinking.
Likewise, was it a bad mark against Farrell? That's the rule of the game. Had it been me and in the same spot, I would have been appointed. There was no method in the area committee to elect a successor. You see, in 1938, in our last conversation, I remarked to you about the irony of that meeting that you attended up in Brainerd, I believe it was. And in 1937, when he sent Picago in to break up those councils, I think Neil was with us that day when we went into Tobin. And Tobin then gave us the limited authority to organize the over-the-road drivers only. That we couldn't get into the general council work, that we had to confine ourselves to one thing, and that Dobbs would be the man to run the show.
Well, I guess that surprises me because Tobin had indicated up until that point that he saw 574 and all of its operatives as rather threatening to him.
Well, he did.
But he did not feel that they were enough of a threat, or did he feel he could not avoid appointing people like Dobbs?
Well, there had been a couple of abortive attempts in Ohio to organize councils of drivers. But they were done on a collaboration basis. And by that I mean they collaborated with certain employers that you'll be the union and you'll get the union work. And they had big scandals in the aggregate industry there, and I don't know how some of the Teamsters Union officials escaped it. I think it was only industry people that were involved, but I'm sure that they had the support of the drivers' union in return for employing union drivers and paying a union scale, which is better than an open shop rate. I think the implied thing was that we won't serve a non-union job, and that brought in, of course, the pressure that they were able to garner most of the big, heavy commercial work. Tobin was leery of these arrangements because I guess he had the red horrors from the Danbury Hatters case, and that's why the Teamsters moved to Indianapolis in the first place. And that's what Tom Hughes told me. Tom was a pretty good friend of mine. Later on, I didn't know him in the early days. He was from Chicago. But he told me some of the history of the Teamsters Union, a great deal of it, as a matter of fact. And that was one of the reasons many trade unions moved into Indianapolis after the Danbury Hatters case, where they had judged, you know, the big damages against the union and its members. So there were several big unions that moved into Indianapolis because of the unique laws that would protect them. And there was a tacit understanding with the trucking employers of Indianapolis that the union would not attempt to organize the drivers in Indiana, in Indianapolis, Indiana, in return for their refuge there, or haven, or whatever you'd care to call it. Of course, the union took that tongue-in-cheek, and when the organization started, they went ahead and organized anyway. It was too late for the employers to do anything. But I think there was a kind of a Mexican standoff when they first moved in there. But Tobin only recognized 574 out of absolute necessity. Mm-hmm. Later on, he came to like Dobbs. Mm-hmm. I had many a close conversation with Tobin as well. And he had great respect for Farrell. And one of the things, of course, that convinced him was a tremendous amount of membership increase that had happened as a result of the over-the-road thinking.
So even by that time, Tobin had gotten over his fear of an expanding membership.
Yes, yes. He recognized, of course, Tobin, you know, was a kind of a goddamn big... a big stick in the AFL hierarchy. Even although his membership was way down, he was far from being the biggest union. But he did have the most power. It was a strategic union. While he had less than 100,000 men in 1933, strategically he had the power. Because he touched every other craft, and particularly in the building trade, which did not prevent the Teamsters Union from being assailed by the operating engineers and others trying to take over jurisdiction of the Teamster work on certain jobs, which the Teamsters held. There was a big fight over the transit mix jobs in the middle 30s when they first started that type of operation. On the cement trucks, the operating engineers led a big fight against the IBT that they should have operating engineers, because it was operating, they had to have a separate machine to dump the truck. Now they're all hooked up to the main plant, but they used to have little gas engines on the back to kick them around on many of them. But Tobin become, I won't say enamored, but very respectful of Farrell's ability.
So he would have been along in the crowd if he hadn't.
Huh?
He would have been alone in the crowd if he hadn't.
That's right.
By this time, Farrell was very well respected, isn't that right?
Oh, tremendous. And a great share, you know, of Tobin's respect for Farrell, I'm sure, come from the close relationship that Farrell had with Sandy O'Brien and Tom Hughes. Now, Sandy O'Brien indirectly played quite a role in the organizing of the area committee. And Ted Neal was with us when we made our first meeting with him in March of 1938. And that Sandy had just returned from Indianapolis, and he had been awarded the jurisdiction of the highway drivers. That is the over-the-road drivers. He was the secretary treasurer of Local 710, which is the meat wagon drivers. That's the correct name of that local.
Meat wagon drivers.
Yeah, they were the meat wagon drivers. They had the yards. And Sandy was their secretary treasurer. He took over when George Kidd died. And so Sandy saw the potential. it was much sharper. And then, of course, Sandy and Tom Hughes were buddy-buddy. And Tom Hughes, of course, had been the Secretary Treasurer for years with Tobin. And they'd gone through the tough years. Now, I don't want to give the idea that Tobin didn't have some rough days in putting the union together in its infancy. And he had a lot of fights along the way to keep it intact. And I imagine, and I have no proof except reading history, and I've made quite a bit of study of it, there were certain elements, hoodlum or otherwise, that wanted to control the union. And Tobin, in his Sam Gomperish manner, he hung on. And it wasn't an easy task. And I sent you some information on the early days of the Teamsters in Chicago in my time, when I was driving and into Chicago, when they killed Patty Burrell and shot up Hank Berger and a few more of them.
Boy, those were violent times.
What?
Those were violent.
Oh, you bet they were. And nobody was out around there, you know, using sophisticated language in the King's English. They shoot you down. They figure if you're dead, you ain't going to talk back. And that's what they did. Now, when he granted the jurisdiction to Sandy O'Brien, I think it was Sandy that probably convinced him that was the thing to do. Because to this day, Tobin has never yet conquered that Chicago Brotherhood of Teamsters. And they remain a power in the city of Chicago. And I suppose Sandy, and from his early talks with Farrell, saw that those who controlled the over-the-road driving would control, to a large degree, the success of the organization of the drivers. And if the Chicago Brotherhood of Teamsters would break out and start organizing the line drivers, they would present not a local sore to Tobin, but one that was festering all over the area to wherever those trucks went. So Tobin wasn't just, I don't think he was aware of the magnitude of what happened until almost, well, by the time he appointed Farrell, by the time he gave us the authority to broaden the strike in Kansas City in the fall of 38, late in the fall, I don't think it was about that the time that I think that Tobin realized really what the area committee would mean.
So he was a little bit slow on the uptake.
Well, there's a class of us Irish that are kind of pig-headed and don't want to yield, and I think we put him in. I wouldn't say that Tobin was slow on the uptake. He was just a little bit stubborn.
Oh, I see.
Hmm?
Okay.
And considering he had a Sam Gompers outlook on the labor movement, not one that was conducive with modern labor leader, because he was pretty bitter, you know, about John L. Lewis and organizing the CIO. He was a big wheel in the AFL Council when they expelled those 11 unions. So I wouldn't say that he was exactly an idiot. He didn't go to school to eat his lunch, perhaps, but he was more stubborn than dumb.
Uh-huh. Well, now, do you think it was the presence of Sandy O'Brien and Tom Hughes that prevented Tobin from placing the Chicago local in trusteeship?
Which one?
Well, the one that he found so threatening.
He never put them in trusteeship.
No, I'm asking, why was it that he wouldn't attempt something like that?
He didn't have control. They were independent. They were never a member.
Oh, I see.
They had been members, I guess, at one time in, when Cornelius Shea was running the show.
So they were totally separate.
Oh, they were totally separated from the word go. He never could put them in receivership. See, the reason that Patty Burrell was killed, and then Henry Berger was shot up, and there was another guy, I can't think of his name. And I was driving truck into and out of Chicago in about 32 when Tobin was trying to suppress the Chicago Brotherhood of Teamsters, and he was doing it by force. And he was losing. until the district attorney for Cook County, the county attorney, got in there, and they used the courts and everything. And the big fights was over the coal drivers at that time. They were trying to get, I think it was Local 703, the coal drivers. And they subdued that local. But they done it through collaboration, just as Tobin later broke up Minneapolis unions, with the help of the court and the constabulary and the government. But he never did have the control over 705. Now, my recollection is, and my knowledge of being around Chicago, that it's people that are connected with the old Toohey mob that were in power in 705. I don't know what the situation is today because I haven't been there for 30 years. I wouldn't hazard authoritatively to say. But I do know that it's been charged that 705 is Capone dominated. And I think I would rule that out. Roger Toohey and Alphonse Capone were not buddy buddies. Tobin never could place 705 in receivership. He would have done it had he had the power.
Uh-huh.
Because to this day, they walk very quietly around Chicago.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to speak disrespectful of them. They're a group to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
Guys that play, you know, they ain't playing croquet. They never did. So you don't go around and say, my dad can whip your dad.
Right.
Well, that's my analogy of it. And I spent a lot of time in the history of the Teamsters Union.
You have a remarkable memory.
Well, thank you. But
you really do. Right? It's wonderful to hear you talk, the way you remember things. Well, what do you think, Mr. Maloney? Should we go after some of the rest of our questions here?
Yes, but now, just let me finally still warm on it. Towards the end of our last conversation, if memory serves me correctly, we were discussing the reluctance of the labor leaders, the reluctance of the leaders of 544 to declare a general strike in reference to a day of observance.
Yes.
Whether the words are exactly coined correctly is no value.
But that's the effect,
yeah. And I pointed out to you that there were some other instances. Well, I was reminded Labor Day on a program on Channel 9, which is the educational, one of the two we have here. We have one in Tacoma and one here. They had a half-hour documentary on the 1934 strike in San Francisco.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it was very interesting. And I'll find out where that come from for you and mail it to you, so in the event that you find it sometime, you know, with your...
That would be very helpful.
And what do you call it? They were pointing out the role there, the particular role that Dave Beck played and Joe Ryan.
Uh-huh.
And that happened just about the time, if memory serves me right, just prior to our instance in Minneapolis. Now, the shootings in San Francisco occurred on July 5. Ours was July 19th.
Right.
There had been a general strike in San Francisco for 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was defeated because of the 40 men that was on the strike committee. Only two represented the waterfront unions, who were the spokesmen. Now, the waterfront unions, one shore side and one from the seagoing side, the maritime union. Although there are three unions on a ship, there's more than that. There's the cooks that make the meals and take care of the bunks, the black gang that manufactures the power, and the sailors who do the sailing, the steering, and maintain the vessel, plus the mates and the engineers and the pursers that used to be on those ships. So the maritime unions had two representatives in a field of 40. And most of the people that were the officialdom of the Central Labor Union, the rank and file, wanted the support. just like they did in Minneapolis. It was the officialdom that were afraid of rocking the boat. And that's how that strike was it proved, and it just struck me because we'd been discussing it. The logic of Carl when he was explaining to me that a general strike, unless it's well organized and everybody got unity of idea and demand, it can be a disaster. And they prevented that by not asking for a general strike. And the sagacity of their thinking didn't come through to me at the moment. It was logical. But as I've had time to review it and done a lot of reading, I don't think Debs could have pulled off a general strike in Minneapolis. And I have a tremendous respect for Debs.
Well, that's really interesting that you would draw that parallel. And I think that that does clarify the logic that they used in not calling a general strike.
Yes. You see what happened? They started unraveling, which Carl said. He says, the first thing that we do, it's too tremendous. He said, it's tremendous. And then later on, I had real serious discussions with Farrell over that. That was a year or two later, mm-hmm. about the why the general strike was not a good thing at the moment.
But during the 34 strike here, the taxi cab drivers went out?
They did, after the shooting. Now, there was a tacit understanding with the Yellow Fleet. We had an agreement with them. Mm-hmm. Not only did they go out, a lot of the streetcar men, mm-hmm. and many of the milk drivers, and there was a wholesale...
Did some of the building
trades? Huh?
Did some of the building trades go out, too?
Some, you bet. There were two fellows that were outstanding in the building trades. Mm-hmm. One was Tubby Crowell. Crowell, and Walter Frank from the Lathers. Crowell was the business agent for the structural iron workers. Then the steam fitters and plumbers, they were a good, solid union. And the carpenters, a yes and no. But those three unions, they were, the day of the shooting, there was a big building under construction in Minneapolis, and the whole structural iron gang marched into the strike headquarters in a body when they heard about it. Now, I don't recall, I was either on my way to the hospital or in it at the time.
Yes, okay.
Hmm?
That's right. You would have been.
Yeah.
Well, so that they chose to walk off the job independently.
Yeah, they were outraged. They were just outraged. Remember, all unions had been subject to the tyranny. And particularly in Minneapolis, the building trades were really under the hammer. The Citizens Alliance was building all those buildings around town with scab labor. The telephone building, I think the Fauché Tower was union. And I drove for Ed Dahlquist when we excavated the basement for Sears Roebuck. And although the union didn't have a contract with Dahlquist, Ed wouldn't fire you if you belonged to the union, no more than Pat Connolly would. They had big fleets of big old chain drive Mack dump trucks. At most of the building trades had been ravaged by the open shop policy of the Citizens Alliance. And those big companies that were in the construction, they were open shop companies. And the Baker Building and the, there was another one there by the Donaldson Building. I forget which that one was.
Well, so that these people who walked off the job in outrage over the killings that had taken place on Bloody Friday, they were not enough to stop the building of the buildings because...
Well, they were key unions. Crowell...
But you said that some of them, they were open shop.
The industry.
Oh, so that...
The industry. You see, when it become necessary to get iron structural iron workers, mm-hmm. you had to get... it was not so easy to get scab iron workers as it was to get scab laborers.
Because
there's
skill.
Quite a bit of difference.
Yeah.
Besides it being a skill, it takes a lot of guts to be up there walking around on an 8-inch beam, you know, 100 feet aloft in the wind.
Okay.
So there were some groups that were key unions. The plumbers and steam fitters are a key union. The building, the lathers at that time, there was no drywall. If a building was going to be finished, the lathers and plasterers had to be there. And Walter Frank was very far advanced in the labor movement. And so was Crowell. And Miller from the Steam Fitters Union was a good plug. And they were key unions. Now, I think the guy that ran the... Now, that reminds me, when we talk about that, I'm going to give you the name of the some of the people that were on the labor board. You asked me one time.
Yeah.
And memory serves me that it was Emory Nelson, who was from 471, the Milk Wagon Drivers Union, and Guy Alexander, who was, I think, electrician, and John Bosco, who come from the printing trades, one of the many printing trades. I forget which one. And then I forget where that Teehee Cunningham come in. His name was T.H. We used to call him T.E. But I forget what role where he was from. You know, I've been away from there for many years, and that's 45 years ago now.
Do you have any idea how these people became members of the Regional Labor Board? Did they offer?
No. I don't think they offered. I think it was part of the con game as I call it, that President Roosevelt pulled off. See, his style was, he instituted that program when he got in, taking over a company that was on a country that was on the verge of revolution, and half the country on the bum, if not two-thirds. So he was no dummy, and he knew that there were going to be labor troubles. Well, if there's going to be labor trouble, that means that you're going to have to deal with it. And he didn't want any embarrassment. So the best way to fool people, you know, is con them. So they set up these labor boards, and he appointed all these committees. And he had all these things going around, and he'd get one guy here and one guy there, and that would kind of neutralize the where the people were indignant and lashing out at the state apparatus and the government apparatus for the shape the country was in. It's kind of hard to lash out when you're serving on a board that's going to restrict you. And Roosevelt was smart enough to see that, and that's what he done. He populated these guys on these labor boards, and this was supposed to be the new day for labor. So we're going to have labor people on the boards. From here on, it won't be just management. Well, a lot of these guys, you know, they were little frogs in big puddles, but they thought it was the other way around, and they just basked in that glory, as I look at it now. And I don't think that they volunteered to Roosevelt. I think they had sharp people around Roosevelt, and who can we get here, and who can we pacify them with here? But I noticed people like Crowell and Miller and Walter Frank weren't appointed to those boards. They took the more weak sister type of guys and put them on those boards.
Well, I've read some of the minutes from some of those regional labor board meetings, and people like Emory Nelson and some of the other labor reps seemed to stand up quite strongly.
Well, they did in those meetings where they were just lip service. When you got right down, push come to shove, well, Emory Nelson probably wasn't as bad as some of the rest of them. It seems to me that didn't he wind up in some kind of scrape with a trucking company?
I'm not sure.
I think he got involved in that incident out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota with that Buckingham Transportation. I think it was Emory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was. Mm-hmm. It happened in later years. But they may have had meetings where they're arguing policy with the management representatives of the labor board. But it was a dress rehearsal.
Well, he sent telegrams to to the president about the role of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
The what?
The role of the Reconstruction Finance
Corporation. Oh, granted, yes, yes. But I remember Emory Nelson trying to convince me, and this is way, this has come later on in one of your questions, to permit attorneys to attend the meeting where we were discussing the fate of the challenged truck driver. Mm. And we walked out of the meeting. And we walked out the second time, and Emory was the spokesman. So I got some vivid feelings about him.
Yeah, I guess you do.
But on the other hand, later on, he and Pat Corcoran saw the that maybe the error of their ways.
Mm-hmm.
But when it come right down to trying to settle a strike over our heads, he played his role in it.
I see.
And it wasn't a good one.
Okay. Well, it's good to have that cleared up, your perspective on that.
On him and Bosco, and now Bosco's not the same guy that's mentioned. There was a guy at the Farm Labor Holiday Association with a very similar name. So you'll want to be clear if I happen to speak good of one guy. It wouldn't be of John Bosco.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the name Walter Frank.
Walter Frank, he was the business agent of the Lathers Union, and if memory serves me, he was also business agent for the Building Trades Council. And Crowell was the business agent or president of the Iron Workers Union, and he was a two-fisted fighter, and if you look through the papers, you'll see it every once in a while. And I worked with his brother when I was a young boy. I was his... Crowell's brother was a driver for the Dayton Company, and I helped him as a helper in the old Robbinsdale route. That was about 26.
Well, one of the other people that we interviewed mentioned Walter Frank and described a scene that he witnessed in which it was a rally at one of the big auditoriums. And people from all of the Minneapolis labor movement were there. And on stage were the leaders of the strike, the 34th strike. And Walter Frank was one of the first to speak. And at this meeting, he absolutely lambasted the leadership of the meeting up one side and down the other.
I don't recall that.
I don't recall that. Okay.
I don't know what meeting that would be.
Well, this person wasn't able to identify it in time, but he wasn't sure why the meeting was being held. But he does recall Walter Frank as being a very vigorous speaker and also very critical of the way the strike was being handled.
I don't recall that.
Okay.
I don't recall that meeting.
Okay.
And I don't recall now, there may have been some thing where Walter Frank might have been critical. But what I was pointing out to you was that Walter Frank was a strong, to my knowledge, he was a pretty strong supporter of the union. And he was a very militant local, the Lathers. Now there was some stories to the effect that Walter Frank may have at one time been more sympathetic to the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not one to red bait people because they're entitled to their own political belief. But there was and I would be amiss to say that there wasn't, there was some criticism, a great deal of criticism, by the Communist Party as it was constituted then in Minneapolis against the Dunns.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I never heard Walter Frank ever making any anti-union criticism. I do know that the Communist Party criticized the strike. They called the settlement a sellout.
Okay.
And all that sort of thing. And they...
Well, didn't one of the William Dunn, the oldest Dunn brother, didn't he play a part in that? He was with the Communist Party at that time.
What?
I'm gonna have to flip the tape.
Just a minute, I'll get some water too.
Okay.
5th, 1975, 9 a.m. This is the second part of two tapes, an interview between Professor Martin Duffy, the University of Minnesota, and Christine Miller, labor research analyst for the University of Minnesota, and myself, concerning the Minneapolis General Drivers' Strike of 1934. These tapes were transcribed September 5th, 1979, commencing at 9 a.m.
Very close to Big Bill Haywood in the Western Federation of Miners, and at one time ran for mayor of Butte, Montana, and missed it by just a few votes. That's in the early days of the Western Federation of Miners. Ray Dunn and Carl Skoglund were also members of the Communist Party. They were all originally members of the Socialist Party. And I got this from Ray, and I got it from Carl. And they told me that up in Michigan, well, I don't know, right, the tail end of the war, the right wing of the Socialist Party kind of got cold feet, and they decided to disband the party, and the left wing of the party organized American Communist Party. And they kept in the same camp and on the same beam until about 1930 or thereabouts, the way Carl explained it to me. And Carl says that he and Ray challenged some of the proceedings against Trotsky, and they left the party. The party says they expelled him. Now, I prefer to believe Carl Skoglund. Bill Dunn remained within the Communist Party, and he was a scribe in New York for the Communist Party paper. And from time to time, the Communist Party would bring in Bill Dunn to speak against his brothers on certain issues. And that happened, I don't know, I couldn't tell you. I know it happened more than once. It happened several times. Now, Mrs. Dunn, the mother, lived with Ray Dunn on, the home was right off of Lake Street on 15th Avenue South. And in the early days, my chore, if I wasn't doing anything, it was set up usually, I would take Mrs. Dunn to the Catholic Boys Orphanage, where she used to sew from 1 to 4 o'clock every Thursday afternoon. Now, there was an unwritten rule that when Bill Dunn come to town, none of the brothers, they always gave their mother the mother's right to visit the son. And they didn't embarrass Bill by being in Ray's home at the time that Bill was there visiting their mother. And they observed that. Outside of that, that was the only truce that I knew that they involved themselves in. But they did, Mickey, which was Miles, and he was the most beautiful speaker of them all, and Grant and Ray were involved in the union. Fenton had a small grocery store down on LaSalle. His wife worked for Western Union. And the other brother, Paul, worked in a One of those warehouses in Wisconsin where they make paper or mills or something like that. I think at Nagusa. But it's true that Bill Dunn used to lambaste his brothers, and they in turn would defend themselves and probably lambaste him in the process. Now, I never heard of Walter Frank in a meeting where the officials of the union were on the platform that he lambasted them. Now, he may have had some political differences with the Dunn brothers, but I'm sure that I never heard of it. And I had respect for Walter, and he had a daughter and a wife, and they used to attend the affairs, and maybe he did, but I never heard of it. And I would tend to doubt it, because Walter had some credits as a trade unionist. But the Communist Party was attacking the leadership. Hell, they were Ape and Tobin. There's no question about that. And they didn't get off the ground, because the guys in the union knew that that kind of stuff was more or less boss-inspired. The bosses tried it first.
Isn't that something that the Communist Party could end up looking like the employers or gang of Tobin?
It is. It is, but the record will show that that's what was done. They put out leaflets, and I do remember the Communist Party played a good role in Minneapolis in the demonstrations and the hunger strikes in the very early 30s. And I also remember that they criticized the settlements of the strikes. They said that it was a sellout. And I do remember that when Pat Corcoran was killed, they started a slander suit against the union, charging the officials of the union of killing him. And that was, I wasn't in Minneapolis at that time. I was out organizing in the area when that went on. But I do remember those incidents, but I'm not, you know, first-rate familiar with them.
Well then, how should we proceed?
Well, it's up to you. You know, you're trying to do this job.
Okay.
Incidentally, about my niece.
Yes.
I talked to my brother Don Sunday. And Christy is working as a some sort of a functionary job in one of the judge's chambers, an Irish judge. And he don't know if it's Ryan or O'Rourke or whoever they are there.
Uh-huh.
But she's also has that, you know, I suppose... Because, you know, when you're a fledgling lawyer trying to get started, those first years are kind of tough.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's what she's doing. I'm going to send you...
That sounds like a good job, though.
Huh?
That's a good job, though.
It may be.
Not everybody can
yeah.
get that close to, you know, the judicial system.
Yeah. Well, she's working for one of them. When I get some information, I'll pass it on.
Good. Yes, do that. Let me, as long as we're not talking directly about the strike right now, let me ask you this. Do you know a man by the name of Walt Engelbert?
Who?
Walt Engelbert. He's an organizer for the Western Conference and lives in Portland, Oregon.
Walt Engelbert? No, the guy I knew out here was Clyde Crosby. Engelbert was appointed to relieve Clyde Crosby. Not to relieve him, but to fill in his boots.
Yeah.
Now, our representatives in Portland say he's a pretty good head.
Yeah. Well, I just wondered, because this person here in the office I mentioned to you, who was interested in the articles on organizing that you sent,
yeah.
He knows Walt Engelbert and has some respect for him, and wondered if perhaps you knew him.
I know of him.
Okay.
And I know that... our representatives, when I say our representatives, although I'm retired, our union, the Longshoremen's Union, has always had a little better relationship in Portland than has been here with the Teamsters in Seattle. And largely, of course, that dates back to the days of Bridges and Beck. And that carries over, and Beck is still on the scene, you know. And of course, kind of controls most of these boys, though most of them are his appointees. But Clyde Crosby was the general organizer for the Teamsters in Portland, and Engelberg is a younger man. I've never met him, but the guys speak well of him. That is, he's not He's not one of these IBT patriots to the end that everybody else is a stinker, and if you ain't the IBT, you're an enemy. I don't know anything about him other than that. But he's in the better group of many of the Teamster organizers that we hear about.
Well, I'll pass that on.
Mm-hmm.
To our friend here. Well, I'd like to pick up where we left off.
All right.
Now,
we were on, let me see where we were. We were at question, I think, about 32. We were talking about two or three of them.
Yes, we were
at 34. The question, was it a turning point in the strike, or was it relatively insignificant? And we were talking about, as I recalled, the last incidents were about the Hawes-Dunnigan Agreement. And so forth. So I think probably to orient yourself, you should do the interrogating.
Okay, well, I think that you gave us a lot of background information leading up to the strike and then talking about the compromise and the whole process by which the employers rejected the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
How much of a turning point was this in the strike?
Well,
they rejected and you accepted, and the negotiators were then again put in the position of attempting to come up with some other terms.
Well, a turning point. Now, the beginning of it, we have to look backwards at it.
Okay.
At the beginning, when it first. When Governor Olson said that this is a good settlement, and when he endorsed the terms of the Hawes-Dunnigan proposal, and when he agreed to, when he stated that it was a good agreement and that he would see that it was lived up to, of course, the men in the union, after having the matter explained to them very thoroughly that morning, recognized what it would really mean, they felt we had won. And that now Olson had really been a friend to some of the men, they figured, that, well, now we've... the governor's on our side and the mediators, and we accepted the proposal. Now the strike is over. Now, Carl Skoglund told me, he said, well, I'm not sure that it's over. The reason that I was closer to Carl was that Carl had a car, an old Whippet. But he lived up on 10th Street, as I recall, and he left the car on the strike grounds, and I used to drive him quite a bit here and there, wherever he wanted to go. And he would talk to me, and I liked old Carl, and he said, I'm not sure, he said, that the employers are ready to accept. And he said, I'm not sure that Olson is ready to do what he said he'd do. Well, it was the next day that Olson declared the martial law. Now, he went farther than calling it martial law. He said there was a state of insurrection.
Okay.
Now, that was a hard one for me to swallow. We'd had agreed to what he said was his idea of a good settlement. And now, who was the insurrectors? Was it the union or was it the employer? But he didn't speak harshly to the employer. He struck out at the union. He absolutely forbid the union to go do any picketing. He forbid us to hold a meeting outside. And then he made an announcement that they would give military protection to trucks, or military permission, not protection, military permission to those truck owners that wanted to sign the Hawes-Dunnigan Agreement. but he put a kicker on it. He said that they, by signing it, was not a final commitment. And all of that is available for you there to read in the documents. And it was explained that if they signed the agreement, it could be interpreted to be only a temporary thing. And if in the end of the strike was all over, everyone that agreed to be bound by whatever was negotiated. Well, this was a perplexing thing to me, because I was pretty young and I couldn't figure it all out like I've since been able to look back and analyze, but I had some real doubts. The strike in itself, the settlement that was proposed in the Hawes-Dunnigan wasn't everything we wanted, but it was basic. And we agreed to accept it. Now suddenly we become the bad guys. The employer said we was all communists, and they couldn't deal with us, and the Communist Party said we was all traitors, and they couldn't deal with us. So we were between the devil and the deep blue sea. So then Olson permitted the trucks to be granted military permits. So it was a turning point, because it, for the first time clearly and without any wraps on it, in my opinion, showed the strike-breaking role that Olson was trying to use against the union. Now, I don't see how anyone else, well, I can see they have difference of opinion. But when you stop to realize that one day Olson says, this is the settlement that can be lived with. This is one that I approve. I recommend its adoption by both parties. This is the one the mediators have spent time working out. The union says, okay, we agree with you. We will accept it. And suddenly, the wrath was turned on the union by Olson. Now, if that didn't prove to me that the Olson here did not feel, apparently, that the union was any consequence, and that his best bet was with the employers for re-election or his political career. Anyway, the record speaks for itself. What did Olson do? He didn't act in an impartial manner. And I know years later, till the time I left Minneapolis, we used to get in disputes with some of the real old staunch stalwarts of the Farm Labor Party that Olson was trying to help us. Well, I never seen a guy at sea being saved from drowning when you throw him the anchor instead of the lifeline. And that's what we got from Olson. So I don't know how anyone could interpret Olson's actions any differently than I did at the time. And he prohibited picketing. Now, if, as Carl pointed out, if you just keep the tin soldiers in the armory and let those people who signed the agreement operate, the strike will win by itself. But Olson didn't do that. He put the troops on the street, and you had to go down there on 6th Street and 4th Avenue, and there was a lineup to almost down to the courthouse for employers waiting to get military permits for their trucks. And Allard E. Walsh had a cramp in his hand from signing them. He was the adjutant general. And they couldn't write them things up fast enough. Now, there was no, and then Olson come out and made the statement that signing the, making a, it was a kind of a third party thing. It was that in the event that the strike was settled, that they would abide by the terms of the Hawes-Dunnigan agreement. That was about the way that it was done. Now, if they had to sign up and accept the Hawes-Dunnigan agreement, then Olson's role might have been more or less justified. But he put the kicker on it. It wasn't a commitment. It was a temporary thing, and it can only be described in my mind as a strike-breaking tactic.
Now that we've established how you feel about whether or not he was strike-breaking, what I would be interested in knowing whether or not you thought it he did that for purely political reasons or if he did that because he simply did not care about the strikers. We've heard so much about Olson as being a radical or a friend to the underdog, and a lot of the stories just don't coincide. What do you
I see Olson as a fellow that is guilty of all the good things you said about him. He was a friend of the underdog. He said that he was a member of the IWW. He said that he worked in the docks in Seattle. He said that he was in the gold rush up to Alaska, whether it was in 1898, I doubt that, but he might have been up there in one of the other futile attempts to mine gold. There was a lot of them going on. All of those things, I wouldn't quarrel that he said or did. The fact that he come from a, not an impoverished, but a working class family in North Minneapolis and what we used to know as Jewtown, and that he grew up and was kind of sympathetic to his people, and I gotta say this, he was loyal to his friends, because when the liquor options come up for grabs in the state of Minnesota, you know, when the state went wet, the story was that out of the 22 districts, 20 of them went to Boyhood Chums, the distributorships, to his friends, and that can be checked out, but I know that that's what Izzy Wolf told me. And so he was loyal to his friends, but I think after the years went on, Olson had aspirations to be set in the White House, and he was more concerned with his career by far than he was that disregarded the strikers. They were something that were incidental. They weren't paramount. What was paramount was Olson's political career. And as I talked to you earlier, he was a fellow with a maverick political base. The Farm Labor Party wasn't accepted as the party in the United States by far. And the Republicans were assailing him at every corner in state politics. So I'm convinced that more than anything else, it was Governor Olson's aspirations for the betterment of his political career that motivated him to do what he did. Now, he may have had regard for the worker, but he didn't have the faith that the union was going to win. The structure in Minnesota was that unions didn't win, the country unions weren't winning. And I don't, he was enough of a politician, you know, to climb around from one ring to the other.
So it sounds as though what you're saying is that he wasn't necessarily more aligned with the employers as opposed to the union, but simply that he wanted to go with the winner.
That's right.
Whoever that might be.
Now, I wouldn't quarrel that Governor Olson may have had some good friends and some close feelings with people who were working class people. He come from a working class family. And I think his, what's his middle name? Wasn't it Thorstein? Named after the Swedish person?
Yes.
His people, memory serves me that his father, Mike, was a dockhand on the MP or the Omaha Railway docks down there. Mm-hmm. And he come up in almost a poverty neighborhood, that Bassett Creek area where he was raised there, right off of 6th Avenue, in his youth was, well, they didn't have sophisticated words like ghettos then. They called them slums. And that's what it was. And so I believe that the reason that he done what he did was his political career. He had more faith in that than he did the benefit or feeling for the strikers. Probably in his heart he didn't care to see the strike broken, but then he felt if the strike's got to be broken at the expense of my, if the strike is going to win at the expense of my career, then I ain't going to see it won. It's hard for me to diagnose Floyd Olson. He was a smarter man than most people, I think, give him credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And I have respect for him. I don't got no respect for his ability, which was pretty good. He had a lot of ability. The trouble was that sometimes he used it more for Floyd Olson than he did for anyone else. Although he done a lot of speech making, so did Ernie Lundeen. And so did old man Lindbergh at one time before he swallowed the anchor. And that's my opinion on Olson.
So that you mentioned that he did not allow you to picket and he did not allow you to hold fresh air meetings.
That's right.
What other kinds of restrictions were imposed on the strikers?
Well, those were the basic ones.
Mm-hmm. Did the employers have restrictions placed on them during this time?
No. No. They were given help by Olson with troops when he put the troops in.
So, well, then what was the feeling about the National Guard?
Huh?
What was the feeling about the National Guard? I know that the employers didn't particularly like the presence of the National Guard.
Well, what they were after was, I suppose, throw the union leaders in jail and run everybody off the streets and let them go. But I don't think that they were really too much upset because the National Guard was there. I can't see where it hurt them any, and I have to discount the fact that they didn't raise too much umbrage about it. I think some of the other things, let's see, he said we couldn't picket. We couldn't hold any open air meetings. No trucks could be on the streets unless they had a military permit. That was the three basic ones, as I recall. Maybe a lot more in that order. That there was a big proclamation there.
Mm-hmm. Well, did the union have any say in how these permits to deliver were handed out?
No. We at one time demanded to have representation on the board that was issuing them.
Was the union able to make any unofficial deals with the guard?
Make any what?
Unofficial
deals. Unofficial?
Unofficial deals with the guard to not let trucks through.
Well,
not give permits.
Absolutely not. Now, I remember we were personally, myself, and who was it? Kelly Postal and Ray Rainbow. It was a committee of five of us. Kelly and Ray and myself. I think George Dreon, I don't know who else. We went down to make a demand on Allard E. Walsh that he quit issuing military permits to these people that were getting them. There was a tremendous wave of them, the issuing of permits indiscriminately. And we were told in no uncertain terms by the aide for Allard E. Walsh, we didn't get to see him. And there was some aide come out, and he relayed the information to Allard E. Walsh, and he was in session with McDevitt and somebody else, and we were informed that Allard E. Walsh would brook no interference from the union in his orders. He was in, was his orders that were being issued, and if we continued to raise any more argument down there, he'd notify the provost marshals to have us apprehended and put in a stockade. So I don't know what anybody else had, but I know that we were elected by the strike committee to go down and bring this message to him. And that's what we got out of it. Now, I don't know what anyone else had.
Well, how would you say the individual members of the Guard, did they feel very comfortable doing what they were doing, or were they anti-union or pro-union?
Well, those that we talked to, for the most part, the guards that they brought up, they brought a detachment like from around St. Peter and places like that, or New Ulm, or, you know, out in that country, I meant. Not St. Peter, but around New Ulm and out in the rural communities. They did not clearly understand what it was all about. Many of them treated it as a lark. It was a chance to get to the city and ride around, and they were mostly riding around, you know. And a great share of them were, they weren't aware of what it was all about. Some of them were a little angry when you talked to them because, remember, they were in full battle dress. And they weren't air-conditioned garments they had. And they had their legs strapped up in them wrapped leggings, and they had all that heavy wool on. It was kind of hot in August and July there, you know. Some of them were personally uncomfortable. But for the most part, I didn't have too much conversation with them, but I think the few chances that I did have, we'd talk to them where they'd have a machine gun and we were there and we'd be talking with them. Some of them were kind of non-committal. Others were receptive. They didn't really know what was going on too much.
Now, were all of them armed? Did they have weapons?
Oh, yeah, they were in full battle dress. They had guns and machine guns and all that.
Were they, as a rule, threatening with those guns?
Were they what? See, I don't hear too well.
The street and the National Guard came.
Huh?
And a National Guardsman came up. Was he likely to pull his gun on you, or?
No, I didn't. Run into that. And I don't think there was a great. They were there. There was a visible display of them. But I don't think when you come up to, I never had them, when I come up to talk to them, what few conversations I had, they didn't put the bayonet on their gun and tell me to stand back. But they were in full battle dress.
We talked to one person who was a member of the National Guard during the strike, and he said that no one had been trained how to use the weapons that they had been given.
I'd say that was a fair assumption.
And that they were mainly young men.
They were.
Green, you know, wet behind the ears.
Yeah, and they were mostly from the rural areas, mm-hmm. where the National Guard was a kind of a patriotic thing, you know, a carryover from World War I. My dad was in the Army, and it was great. America made the world safe for democracy. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a good thing. They marched, and I guess they used to get about $2 a drill session, mm-hmm. and then they got a chance to go to camp, and they used to go up there by Fort Ripley, up there by Little Falls, and they'd go for a couple of weeks in the summertime. You know, it was a kind of a lark for them.
Mm-hmm.
That they were not trained in battle. And I'm quite sure that the fellow told you they didn't know too much about the weapons they were entrusted with. I think that's true. And the way that they handled themselves when we decided to go for broke proved that they didn't have too much of a taste for that. When they saw what it was all about, many of them just didn't have the guts, I think.
So they weren't a real strong opponent against you, except for the permits.
Well, I don't know. I don't suppose everyone approaches life the same way I do. Where I'm not terribly impressed by authority, and I wasn't at that time afraid of too many things. So I don't know if I would be an average person, but I know the average person, the psychological effect of seeing a bunch of policemen lined up, a bunch of guardsmen lined up with bayonets, with weapons that can fire, that it doesn't have some degree of effect on people. I think one would be most unwise to say that it doesn't.
Sure.
And after we saw that cold-blooded murder demonstration pulled off by the police there on Bloody Friday, you had to recognize that that weapon was there and that it could be used, and you with bare hands didn't have much of a chance. So I would have to rule that the average guy in the union, it did have a psychological effect on him. But it didn't seem to impress me very much.
Well, I was just intrigued by the whole issue of the National Guard, especially when I heard from this one National Guardsman that those people were not terribly interested in being there.
They weren't. I thought they were there for a lark. Now, the officers of the National Guard are a different thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
Sure.
And there were some eager beavers in that group, too, because... there were some, you know, proponents of the Washburn-Crosby clan around in there, and I use that name as a symbol, not as a fact, you know. The Millers had some sons in there. Of course, for the most part, they weren't the foot soldiers, you know. They were the fellows that rode around in them little trucks they had. They didn't have Jeeps at the time, as I remember. They had mostly them Chevrolet trucks.
Well, another person who served on the National Guard was also a union member at the time.
Of our union?
Yes.
That's entirely possible.
And he was compelled to go with the National Guard. He
mm-hmm.
was out of it. And he said that he just wore his union button on the inside of his cap.
Well, I don't suppose he exhibited it on the outside.
No, no. And he said he just would look the other way at the appropriate time.
Yes, I'm sure they did. Well, I know that when... we decided that we'd had enough of the tin soldiers, and they raided our headquarters, and there was no way to go but fight.
Mm-hmm.
The National Guard was pretty much up against it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of them were hurt, not so much in physical encounter, because those days you didn't have this sophisticated, elaborate two-way radio and helicopter system.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew the streets, they didn't. So we could be like the shadow, you know, we could hit and strike and go. And before they got there, we were someplace else. And that's the way it went for a few days. And some guys got caught, not maybe right in the act of persuading some guy to take his truck and return it, or have it returned for him, as by accident. Because they did not have, you know, today that... Hell, if you're out on Lake Street and you start down Lake Street, by the time you get to Nicollet from 27th Avenue South, there's 18 squad cars on your tail coming from every direction. They didn't have that those days. So if you could get around the corner, you was home free just about. And the chances were that you would encounter another detachment of National Guardsmen around there, and they might stop you or run you over. I mean, not run over you physically, but push you over to the curb, you know, and take you into stockade. That happened.
So, you clearly feel that the presence of the Guard was a harmful one.
It was. Sure, it's a thing that... there's the constabulary lined up, and all you got to do is go down and get a permit from the Guard. Now you got the Guard protecting the trucks that are taking your job. That is harmful, exceedingly harmful. It was a psychological bad scene.
When did the Guard leave? Did they leave prior to the settlement?
Nope, they were there.
Throughout?
They were there throughout. And we were there.
Think that there was any good that came from their presence?
None. Absolutely none.
So you would say that the settlement didn't have anything to do with the presence of the Guard or its effect on the...
No. I'm convinced that that settlement come about because of Franklin Roosevelt didn't want any further embarrassment of it.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been beset upon, you know, and there was two strikes raging at that time, one on the West Coast and one here. And it's hard for you to hold forth an image that I'm a friend of the workers, regardless of Falla and everything else in your fireside chats, when all this labor trouble that you swear is going to not be happen anymore is continuing. And he used his ace mediator to come in there and wrap it up.
Well, what I'd like to do, how do you feel that you've covered, said all you would like to say about the National Guard?
Well, I want to say this in parting.
Okay.
That when the National Guard is on the street,
uh-huh,
and they're issuing military permits, some of the weaker guys in the Union return to work, or where the presence of the National Guard gives a prima facie opportunity for the employer to run his truck with scabs, the National Guard, even if they are, and I wouldn't quarrel with the fellow says they were untrained, mostly farm kids, didn't understand what they were doing. I mentioned later life, many of them regret being there, but didn't know. The weaker men in the Union, those that felt that the Union would be wiped out, and there they'd be. The National Guard had a very devastating effect upon the men, and it wouldn't have been for the leadership of the Union deciding that the only thing we can do is fight. I felt the presence of the National Guard and the paramilitary permits, with Olson's cracking out at the Union, would have done the strike in.
What I would like to do next time we talk is discuss the raid by the Guard on the Union headquarters.
Oh, yes.
And I think that would be question number 40.
Well, that means that we've got over, let me put my glasses on.
All right.
We got over 36 and 37. And well, I just give you my summary on the Guard.
Yes.
That does bring us down to
the next one, and the next page, and we've covered that.
Well, that'll be question 40 that we're going to talk about next.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's the raid and the strike headquarters.
Uh-huh.
That's after the meeting in the parade grounds.
Yes.
Hmm?
Yes, uh-huh.
So that we got our chronology lined up here.
Okay. Did that look right to you?
It does to me.
Okay. Well, shall we start there in our next discussion?
Yeah, let me mark it, 1940. I mean, question 40. We start there on what day?
Well, let's see. Next week, the State Fed Convention, the AFL-CIO,
mm-hmm,
we're going to be tied up with that. So I would say the week after, so perhaps 2 weeks from today?
Fine.
That would be...
Yeah, I don't have a calendar. I overlooked it.
Okay, that would be Wednesday, September 19th.
Just a moment.
Right.
Wednesday... September
19th.
At 9 o'clock your time, 11 o'clock your time and 9 here, right?
That's right. Uh-huh.
All right.
All right.
So, yeah, I have it now then. Wednesday, September 19th,
uh-huh,
at 9.
Yep.
And we'll be commence on question 40.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you are getting some measure of enlightenment on these discussions.
Oh, I think we certainly are. You are.
Huh?
You're a valuable resource. We really appreciate it. I still wish that either we could come out there or you could come out here.
Well, I don't think I'm in shape to make a trip right now, right at the moment.
Are you still having problems with your
arm?
Yeah.
Yes, and I'll... The doctor told me the other day, I go to a very good orthopedic surgeon, and
uh-huh,
see, I've ruptured the long tendon in the right arm, and
oh,
and that can't be, there's no way that comes together. I understand the treatment is, or the remedy is, and there is a measure of no success, but it's generally they operate and they staple the tendon back to the bone with some platinum staples or something.
Is that what they're going to do with you?
Well, it's not a harrowing thing. It's inconvenient. You have your arm in a sling for about 3 weeks afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an inconvenience, particularly as my major arm.
Mm.
And how are you coming with school? Are you enrolled now?
Oh, yes, I'm in. I've been going to school at night, and I'll tell you, every single minute of my time is accounted for.
Oh, boy, I know.
Boy.
Mm. I'm retired, but I don't seem that I have any time either. I don't know where it goes. Well, then I'll look forward to hearing from you on the 19th.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Miller.
You bet.
Bye-bye.